Thank you, Tony. Well, I'll try to convince you that physics still is flavor physics. A lot of physics still is flavor physics. Okay. So I'm going to start this out on a rather simple level, so the professional high-energy types need to bear with me for a minute, and then we'll get on to a little more detail. So as Tony has basically referred to, there have been, for the last decade or so, two asymmetric B factories, PEP2 at SLAC and KEK B in Japan, with associated experiments, Babar and Bell. And they were built primarily to study CP violation in B meson decay, which has a particularly clean theoretical interpretation. They've been in operation now for more than 7 years, and they'll continue for a little while. Babar will run through this fiscal year. At Bell, they will run for 2 more years, and they are trying to get various kinds of extensions. The accelerators, as I'll show you, have performed very well. They've exceeded their design luminosity by a factor of 3 in the PEP2 case and a factor of almost 2 in KEK B case, and experiments have more than met their primary physics objectives. And they have also provided hundreds of unique and or improved measurements of heavy quark and heavy lepton decay, and Babar is well over 300 papers at this point. So it's fair, I think, at this point to ask, what have we learned about the quark sector of the standard model, the lepton sector as well? Is there more to learn? Is the study of heavy quark and heavy lepton physics even relevant to the new physics that we hope we'll begin to see hints of very soon at the LHC? And of course, a related corollary is, could a vastly increased data sample of heavy quark and heavy lepton decays, such as I'll show you, can be produced at a new asymmetric B factory, contribute to an understanding of physics beyond the standard model? So the main physics objectives of the current generation of experiments have been to ascertain whether the single CP violating phase in the CKM matrix of the standard model can account for the measured CP asymmetries in B meson decay, where, as I said, the interpretations are particularly clean theoretically. And that's possible because there's a class of tree-dominated decays, first-order weak decays, to CP eigenstates in which various hadronic effects, due to the fact that you're looking at a decaying meson, not a decaying quark, are either absent or quite small and manageable. The kicker in all of this is that these clean CP eigenstate decays have a very small branching ratio, the order of 10 to minus 4, 10 to minus 5. So you need a lot of data in order to see them, and you need the special configuration of an asymmetric collider. I won't dwell any further on that point. And as I said before, there have been lots of corollary measurements. So B mesons, just to set the stage, are the next to heaviest mesons containing the next to heaviest quark, the B quark. And we study, in fact, the neutral B meson primarily, and the charged. So I'm not going to even talk about the charge at least here. So we're talking about 5 JeV, lifetimes of 1.5 picoseconds. And decays, which we model as dominated by the light quark spectator model. In other words, we worry only about the decay of the B quark, and the light quark goes along for the ride. And what I've illustrated here is the what we call the golden mode, the decay B goes to J psi K short, in which it is most precisely possible to measure CP violating asymmetries. Whoops. Okay. So now there are other decays, QCD penguin diagrams, higher order diagrams, in which here's an example. This is the decay phi K short, which you'll hear more about later, which are somewhat more difficult to calculate precisely, but and would complicate the interpretation of the CP violating asymmetries. And there is, in fact, a diagram that looks like that, but it has the same weak phase and is very heavily suppressed in this case. And there are, if we're to be complete, even further electroweak penguin diagrams. So these are, depending on what you're measuring, either very interesting or an annoyance. Okay, so I'm showing you this not to insult your intelligence, but rather just to make a point. We have a neat, compact picture of the standard model, and it has three generations and of quarks and three generations of leptons and force carriers and all the stuff, right? Now, it's a beautiful package. We know it's incomplete, and so we are motivated to look for a new physics. But just looking at the picture, there are a whole lot of questions that that are buried here, okay? Why are there three generations? We're pretty sure there are three. Why are there three? We can't answer that question. We have mixing in this quark sector, and we know we have mixing in the neutrino sector, and we have flavor violation in the neutral lepton sector. So a logical question is, well, what do we know about the charged lepton sector? As far as we know, the tau and the mu are just heavier copies of the electron, and everything goes through. But you do expect, in the standard model, you expect charged lepton flavor violation to be extremely small. But in many extensions of the standard model, there are new physics connections which make which raise the level of lepton flavor violation quite substantially, and I'll try to show you, to a level which may in fact be measurable. So there are lots of deeper questions that are buried inside this simple picture. Okay, so let's just skip this one. Okay, but not that one. Okay, so there is, I just need to explain one little thing. The CKM matrix, which describes the mixing of quarks, is a unitary matrix, which means it can be described by three real numbers and one phase. And that is, we typically use the Wolfenstein parameterization, in which the real numbers, I keep doing this, I'm sorry, this is a new device, and I've got to find out where the buttons are. Okay, so one parameter is lambda, the old Khabibbo angle, which is known extremely well. Another is A, which is related to the rate of B meson decay and is also quite well known. And then there are two other parameters, rho, the third real parameter, and eta, the imaginary parameter, which we know before we began these experiments very little about. So the idea was to parameterize our ignorance in terms of these two not very well-known parameters. And when you impose the unitarity conditions, or a set of them, and the most readily, I'll show you, the most readily measurable one is we call the B unitarity relation, and it forms a closed vector in the complex plane, and here it is. So you can write it this way and typically normalize the base to 1. And so you have a triangle, and the question then is this triangle a closed figure or not? Is the standard model self-consistent? And so you know, of course, that you can completely determine a triangle by any combination of three sides and angles. So before these experiments, we knew something about the sides, nothing about the angles. We now have measured individually all three angles as well as the sides, so we have a whole series of over-constrained tests of the standard model. And these angles are related to these particular phases of the coupling constants in the CKM matrix. And the golden mode I referred to measures the sine of twice this angle, sine 2 beta. Okay, so in order to do this, all you need to do is build yourself an asymmetric collider, which we did at SLAC. Here's the 2-mile injector and two rings for an asymmetric collider and the Bombard detector. And I won't say anything more about the Bombard detector. And then you take a lot of data. And so here is, as a function of year, starting in 2000 up to the present, the accumulated luminosity in PEP2 and Babar, and the similar luminosity accumulation in KEK. And so you can see that these machines have improved steadily. This slope keeps going up. And you can see that the integrated luminosity at design luminosity would be here for PEP and here for KEK-B. So these machines have dramatically exceeded their performance goals. And without going through any further details about the physics, here's the bottom line. You can, in fact, make this unitarity triangle construction, having measured sine 2 beta, in fact, sine 2 alpha, and then gamma, which is measured in a somewhat different way. And there are a whole set of constraints here because of experimental and theoretical uncertainties on the measurements of the sides, which are measured by measuring decay rates, and the angles, which are measured by measuring CP asymmetries. And so here is sine 2 beta, which is the best measured. There is a twofold ambiguity, which has been resolved by additional experiments. So we know that this is the correct slope. And this yellow region here is the overlap region. So you can see that, in fact, this triangle has non-zero area, which means that CP is violated. And you now have a rather precise measurement of the value of the amount of CP violation in the quark sector of the standard model that's just related to eta. So the CKM model has passed this unique set of overconstrained tests. You can do all kinds of interesting further tests. You can now have enough separate measurements so that you can ask all kinds of questions. You can say, well, here are all the measurements except for sine 2 beta, and so you can infer from that that the measurement of sine 2 beta is highly constraining to what you learn about CP violation. You can look at only tree-dominated measurements, like the VUB over VCB and the measurement of gamma by comparing branching ratios, and you get a region. You can look at only those decays that involve mixing, and you get a result. And you can look at only CP-violating measurements. When we began this experiment, we knew nothing about CP-violating asymmetries. We now have enough measurements of CP violating quantities that we can get quite a good determination of the unitarity triangle by CP violating quantities alone. Okay? So we've done, we've learned a lot. Okay, so how much have we learned? The Science magazine says that we have proved that their explanation of the matter-antimatter asymmetry is essentially the whole story. Okay? And so the tidy triangle dashes hopes for exotic undiscovered particles. Okay, well, I mean, in Pauli's words, that's not even wrong, and that's what I'm going to try to convince you. So the first obvious thing which is mentioned there is the baryogenesis motivation. I won't go through all the details, but basically in order to produce the matter-antimatter asymmetry, you need to have violation of C and CP symmetry along with baryon number violating interactions, etc. And so we've seen this, and the unfortunate thing is that amount of CP violation doesn't do the job. So that can mean that the baryogenesis is not the answer, and maybe leptogenesis is the answer. But we certainly don't know that. Leptogenesis requires, for example, the neutrinos to be Majorana, and we don't know that. So, I mean, there's an important open question there. And I just love that cartoon. So, anyway. So, if my contention is correct and Science magazine had got it wrong, then what are the objectives of a new round of experiments? Well, the obvious one is what I said. Whoops. Are there new CP-violating phases? The baryogenesis idea requires that they be there, so can we find them? Okay? Well, within the SEEK, the three-generation CKM model, there is one phase, we've measured that phase, and that doesn't give you enough CP violation. So are there other sources? In any extension of the Standard Model, there are many, many other sources of CP violation. And so it becomes, I think, an experimental question of can you observe them? Okay. What? No? No. He's saying that because we haven't seen them, do we therefore know that they're too small to affect the baryogenesis argument? I think the answer is no. Yes. 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 Baryogenesis is not ruled out experimentally. Okay. So, but there are other things. Right-handed currents. New physics could have substantial right-handed currents. New flavor-changing neutral currents through loop contributions. New Higgs fields. Lepton flavor violation. Okay. Maybe we'll find a new flavor symmetry. And I'm. My point is that these ideas can be addressed at a very high luminosity plus E minus collider. So here, there are lots of Standard Model extensions on the market, and not all of them, but many of them have new physics that affects B physics. Okay, so you can have Standard Model-like B physics in a particular class of models. You can have ambiguous range like low tan beta in the minimal supersymmetric model, but you can have Susie Gutz theories and other layer dimension models, etc., which produce measurable effects. Okay, and so the question is, you know, how do you go about isolating these things? So, among the zillions of models of new physics on the market, there are a set of benchmarks called the snow mass points and slopes, and I've overlapped them here. They're called SPS 1 to 9, and I've overlapped them so you can basically just see the squark, the supersymmetric squark sector here, and the scale is this. And so your sensitivity to new physics depends very much on the scale. If it's a model that has a very high scale for the supersymmetric partners, then you have less sensitivity. On the other hand, if you're in this range of 500 GeV or so, you have things that are actually quite measurable. Okay, so how do you go about doing this? Well, Val Taleghdi said a famous thing once, yesterday's sensation is today's calibration and tomorrow's background. Okay, so we can actually instantiate this quip. Okay, and let's just go to the next slide. So what that means is that our calibration is in fact the precision measurements of the of Standard Model flavor physics from all that we've done in B sub D decays, from the mixing in B sub S decays, from Fermilab, from the limits on EDMs, flavored changing neutral currents, limits on lepton flavor violating processes, etc. All of these things already provide substantial constraints for physics beyond the Standard Model. And in fact, rule out lots of popular models, which produce, for example, too large electric dipole moments. So at a minimum, you can say, I can make a set of measurements that place further constraints. That's interesting, may not be sufficient motivation. But you can, in fact, make measurements which have some actual chance of seeing something. Okay. Just to give you an example, you can ask a question, could there be room for new physics in mixing? In a model-independent way, you can parameterize the mixing in terms of a strength and a phase, and then you can ask in this theta d rd plane, where you would be at 1 and 0 if there were no effects. There is, in fact, a small discrepancy. If you translate that discrepancy into the rho eta plane, you can see here that this central value is not precisely aligned there. Now, that's not a huge effect, but it's intriguing. It's not... Well, here's the... Yeah, this is the scale here. 1 minus the confidence level. So by the time you get to the blue, so 2 sigma is like up around here. So look over here. This is where you can. So the blue is, by the time you get to the blue, you're down here at the at like 3 sigma. Okay, so that's not anything to write home about, but it's intriguing. Okay, so I want to emphasize that the reason for going forward with this kind of physics is not to improve the unitarity triangle construction. I'll try to show you that it's other things beyond this which are what are interesting. But nonetheless, it will happen ipso facto. If you get this luminosity, it will happen. Now, is it worth doing? Well, if you improve the lattice calculations the way people say you can, so that the errors on the dominant quantities that have biggest theoretical errors go down as predicted, then at 50 inverse Atabarns, you would have a construction that looked like this if central values remained the same. Okay, that's an extraordinary precision measurement attacked from many, many different directions. And it is an order of magnitude improvement in your knowledge of the position of the apex of the unitarity triangle. Okay, so as I said, this is not the motivation, but it would be a nice thing to have as a byproduct. Okay, so the point is, you're unlikely, in fact, to find new physics, we now have experimental evidence, in tree-dominated processes. We understand how that works, and it works. Okay? So the place to look for new physics is elsewhere. Okay? Well, the first obvious thing is go to the LHC and find the new particles. Okay? But that's not enough. If you can find deviations from standard model predicted quantities, like lepton flavor violation, like various flavor changing neutral current processes, like new sources of CB violation, and this, of course, is not the business of the B factory, except that, I'll just show you very briefly, you can, in fact, make a competitive measurement of the electric dipole moment of the tau, which would be a very interesting thing to do. Okay, so we have these flavor-changing neutral current processes. You can, in fact, measure the anomalous moment of the tau with a polarized beam. I'll have that again in a slide. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, so there are a whole bunch... Whoops, sorry. Here we have a whole bunch of neutral current processes, and they could either involve loops or they can involve decays. And if we instantiate these into particular decays, we can confront the models. Now, how do you do this? If there is a quark mass matrix, then it's probably a reasonable conjecture that there's a quark mass matrix. And so here it is in the D sector. And so at the LHC, if you find these mass eigenstates, you will have learned about the diagonal terms in that matrix. If you want to learn about the off-diagonal terms in the matrix, then you've got to look at these kind of processes that occur in processes that can be really effectively only measured at B factories. And so there's a model-independent way to parameterize these, a mass insertion approximation, in which you have exchanged something and you just characterize it by its chirality and by a mass scale. And what to translate that into more familiar terms, basically these kind of penguin processes in the standard model can have contributions from these kinds of exchanges, which can have, of course, new phases, and therefore new sources of CP violation. Okay. Now, with current statistics, we can't ferret out these kind of things, but with a lot more data, we likely can. So, I mean, you can easily see how this works in a particular example. I've referred to the psi k short. Here's the other thing I referred to, the simplest penguin, phi k short. Okay. So this is a tree, and this is a penguin, And this has a weak phase of beta. Okay? And it turns out this has a weak phase of beta. Okay? That's interesting. So you would expect this decay and this decay to therefore have the same CP asymmetry. So does it or doesn't it? Well, I'll show you in the next slide. But because this is a penguin diagram and therefore a small amplitude, other things like a charged Higgs or other supersymmetric objects can run around in that loop and compete and add an additional phase, which means that the CP asymmetry that you might measure in this decay is different from the one you might measure in this decay. Okay. Now, in order to do that, well, the first point is that these the psi k short branching ratio is 4, 10 to the minus 4, and these others are as much as 100 times smaller. So obviously, in order to do this well, you need a lot of data. You also need control of the corrections, because there are suppressed standard model corrections, too. These have been calculated. They are either bounded or calculated typically at the 5 or 10%. That they're no bigger than 5 or 10% of the change in the asymmetry. Okay, so here's a collection as of this summer of the various penguin modes compared to sine 2 beta, which is this vertical line. And so you can just at a glance, and these are both Babar and Bell, and the agreement is reasonable. And so the first thing you can see is that there's not enough statistics to say anything. There is a very small effect, but it's less than one sigma, so which is the same statement as you can't say anything. Okay. If you take the average of all of these, you get this one sigma effect. Now, you're not going to prove that there's new physics by averaging eight modes and saying, even I have a three sigma effect or something. What you need to do is find one mode in which you understand the corrections and you make the measurement and show that it is substantially different, say, five sigma from the standard model. Then you'll have learned something. It takes a lot of data. How much data? These measurements are basically all statistics limited, so you can just extrapolate them on a log-log plot. So here's integrated luminosity. We're typically around here. So here's psi k short, so we're at the sort of 4% level of precision at this point, which is kind of amazing to me, but we are. And here at the top, here are a bunch of these other modes, but here's phi k short. So you can extrapolate that. So right now, it's at the level of a 20%, sort of 30% measurement. Not good enough to really learn anything. So how much data do you need? Well, this is 10 inverse attobarns. This is 50 inverse attobarns. The sum total of the two experiments now is beginning to approach one inverse attobarn. Okay? So you need to get way up here. If you do that, then, for example, you see that phi k short at 50 inverse attobarns would have an error which is comparable to what we have now on psi k short. And then you could actually learn something by making that comparison. So that's how you arrive at this scale that the accelerator needs to have a luminosity of 10 to the 36 compared to the few 10 to the 34 that we have now. Okay? And if you do that, then we get 15 inverse attobarns a year, in a running year, or say in 5 years, 75 inverse attobarns. And at that level, you can make a statement. Okay, so with 50 inverse attobarns, this is a super Keck B calculation, but the same deal. Here is if the current central values were maintained, and of course there's no guarantee of that, just to demonstrate, here with this level of statistics would be the measurement. This is the asymmetry delta T, and the amplitude is proportional to sine 2 beta. Okay, so here is what you get in the golden mode, and here is what you get in this phi k short penguin mode at 50 inverse attobarns, and now you can make a statement. Okay, and in fact, you can translate that into coverage in a new physics phase and an amplitude, in this case, for left, right, right, left chirality, and you can see this is 5 sigma. And, you can see that you cover a good fraction of that plane. Whenever, because it's interference, there's always an area around zero where you just can't do anything. Right? That's just life. Okay, then there are other penguin-dominated modes, like this one, SL plus L minus, where we have experimental data now, and in fact, people from here have worked on that in Babar. And the interesting thing here is that if you look down here at very low mass of the lepton pair, and you look at the forward-backward asymmetry, which is defined here in this frame, I won't go through the details, there is a very very precise standard model prediction that there will be a zero in that forward-backward asymmetry at this place. Best known in inclusive calculations rather than exclusive. Okay? But the interesting thing is that there are various other models which change the Wilson coefficients in magnitude, and they can change them in sign, and they can either, for example, change the direction at which you approach the zero, or they can, in fact, lift the zero altogether. Okay, so you have a whole set of things you want to check here. Is there a zero? If so, what's the position? If there isn't, you're home free. That's great. Okay, and we're beginning to learn how to do this. This is just an investigation of the sensitivity, and I won't spend the time on it because I'm behind here. Okay, here's another one. We said K or K star L plus L minus. Now, that can either be E or mu. Now, lots of models have different couplings between electrons and muons because they're different, you know, different generations, and you wind up with different couplings. And here's a calculation of Hiller and Kruger in which, now, as a parameter, you take the branching ratio of B sub S to mu mu, and you can see that this ratio of the branching ratio of E's to mu's varies depending on some other parameter. So you can, by being able to measure this branching ratio and asymmetry both in electrons and muons, learn more about models beyond the standard model. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about quarks. I want to spend the rest of the time on leptons and about a little bit about the accelerator. Okay, we know that, I've already said, that lepton flavor is violated in neutrinos, so is it violated in charged lepton decay processes? Well, there are ways we can investigate this. And there are different classes of rare decays that you can look at. I'll show you a compilation in a second. One is tau goes to L gamma. Let's say tau goes to mu gamma, which is manifestly lepton flavor violating. And we make these measurements now. And here's a kind of a signal region. This is an example of a decay that has an irreducible background, which means it, in a case of this sort, you gain as the square root of the ratio of the of data samples. Okay? Here is another lepton flavor violating process, like tau goes to 3 mu's, in which there really isn't any background. This is the latest experimental result from Babar, where there in, you can see in this a signal box region, there's nothing. There is other background around. That's because we took a very conservative approach and didn't work very hard at trying to reduce it because it didn't help improve the limit. But you can, in fact, get rid of this. So this is an example where things scale as 1 over the luminosity. So you expect, I neglected to show you in the previous slide, in 75 inverse Atabarns here, you'd be able to have a sensitivity around 2 10 to minus 9. Okay? In this one, because of the lack of background, you can get to, say, 2 10 to minus 10. So what does that mean? If I look at, so here's a summary of those kind of sensitivities over here for a whole bunch of those lepton flavor violating modes. Here are the Bell and Babar measurements now, which are beginning now to just poke through the 10 to minus 7 level. And here is a compilation of some models and the range for, there's a whole bunch of different decay modes here. Okay, the range that they are predicting for these branching ratios. So, okay, so here is 10 to minus 8, here is 10 to minus 9. So if you look at, say, mu gamma, and I said we have a sensitivity of 10 to minus 9, what does that mean? We're not talking about improving the limit, we're talking about measuring the branching ratio, which I think makes all the difference in the world. Okay? And the same is true if you go up to mu mu. Here the predictions are, again, at the several 10 to minus 9 level, and we have sensitivity at the 10 to minus 10 level. So you should be able, actually, to see some events. No, beyond the standard. It's a compilation of your... The standard model predictions are infinitely... Typically, yes. I mean, there's a point I wanted to make, which I'll make on another slide, but I'll say it now. When you look at those snow mass points and slopes, when those things were determined, those various models, they didn't care a damn about flavor. Okay? So, but there are nonetheless, because of the mass scale, there are consequences for flavor physics. Okay? But various people have grafted on flavor sectors. I'll show you an example of one that has three heavy neutrinos, for example. Okay? Well, you can exclude large numbers of models. That's the only thing an experimentalist can do. I can't control the ingenuity of theorists. Okay, you have the you have the sensitivity. The point is that this is a typical. These are not cherry picked. I mean, this is a typical sort of range. In different models. Precisely. You have to have a specific extra set of models, and there are dozens on the market. Okay. Which one do those come from? I don't know. Okay. I'll show you a couple of examples of specific new physics. Let's see. Here's a model which is SO10 plus a seesaw. Okay, from Mazzero et al. Okay? To deal with the neutrino. To control the neutrino sector. Okay, so there are a set of parameters. So they Monte Carlo over all those parameters. This is the branching ratio of tau to mu gamma. Okay, and this is a function of m to the 1/2 in a Sugra type scheme. Okay, so here's where we. And remember, this is a log scale. So here we are now, kind of. And the sensitivity that it fell off this thing. It should be here. The sensitivity that we have is over here. So you exclude all but a few points in that phase space, okay? And that's some kind of a respectable model, right? I mean, it depends on the value of 10 beta and all of that, but they Monte Carlo'd over that. So you're really making an impact on a respectable model. Here's another way to look at the same thing. Here's in the M0, M1/2, M subgroup. Yes? I've long forgotten what the parameter is. The point is we can exclude it. All right? And okay, here's another way of looking at the same thing. In the M0 plane, here is an area where you have some sensitivity. This is cold dark matter, allows you to go. But you hear, when you get up to 10 to minus 9, you've all except for that little tiny piece there is excluded. Okay. So the point is, it's not just improving the experiments, it's actually confronting models and knocking them out of the box, which I regard as sort of what I get paid for. I don't know. Where is the mixing put in?
I thought it was that, I'm just guessing that it was that delta number.
Presumably that controls it, yeah.
But I don't know the physical.
Yeah, but I don't. I don't remember. I mean, there are so many models. In all these things, I think they're put in by hand, aren't they? I mean, they're constrained by some set of measurements, but yeah. Okay. So, I mean, here's this one I was just referring to. Here's a model of these gentlemen. It puts in leptospheric flavor violation via a seesaw. That's the title of the paper. Okay, so it's the MSSM plus three right-handed neutrinos plus their associated SUSY partners. And here it actually makes connection with various snowmass points and slopes. Each of these is corresponds to a different model. And so here, as a function of the mass of one of these right-handed heavy neutrinos, you get a branching ratio for tau. And you see we get down here. And so you can exclude large regions of this phase space. Typically, everything I'm saying here about here's like, for example, u to e gamma. Okay, I'm talking about things we can measure. Other people are, in fact, at this moment engaged in measuring things like that, and so there is a complementarity here, because we're talking about different generations and different kinds of unified models make different assumptions about the generation. So one isn't a substitute for the other. They complement one another. Okay. So here's an interesting thing. If you can in fact see events, if you have this sensitivity at the level of 10 to minus 10 for three leptons, You're not talking about ratios of limits, but ratios of branching ratios. And here are just three models which produce very different ratios of three leptons to lepton prime plus gamma in various combinations. And so you can see that they vary just all over the map, from large and greater than one to smaller than one, and sometimes very much smaller than one. So you can discriminate. What is LHD? I no longer remember. Little head. That sounds plausible, but I don't remember. Okay. Here's an interesting thing. Here, if you have polarized taus, then you get different Dollitz plots. If you look at tau goes to three leptons, depending on the chirality of the couplings. Okay, so here is a paper by Monell and his group about you have to worry about, because there's a dipole radiation term and then there's an interference term. So the bottom line basically is you're looking for the difference between this kind of a distribution on a Dollitz plot and this distribution for left-handed and right-handed sort of couplings. Okay, now that's great in a density plot. Here's what it looks like if you had 100 events. Now, 100 events is more than I could claim you would see, but I think it's plausible to see that you can make these distinctions even with 10 events. Okay, so if you see lepton flavor violation, that would, one, be a good thing, and two, you can go on and learn something about the coupling. So you have to, therefore, be able to produce beam polarization. And so the obvious thing to do is to have a longitudinally polarized electrons and low longitudinally polarized positrons. It turns out to be easy to make longitudinally polarized electrons and very difficult to make longitudinally polarized positrons. So how much do you lose by the fact that you can't? Well, the polarization typically of the tau typically goes like the sum of the polarizations over this. Okay, so if you look at the electron polarization and the positron polarization, let's say you're in a situation in which is where you kind of are, where you can get 85% electron polarization and zero positron polarization. So you're still getting a very large fraction of longitudinally polarized taus. Now you lose in the cross section, because, you know, some of the photons become sterile, if you like, right? So you lose in the cross section. Here's that factor. We won't worry about that. But you can do the job with one polarized electron. Okay, so we are building into our new machine, which I'm going to tell you about if I have a few minutes, polarization of the electron beam. We know how to do it. We know how to produce longitudinally polarized electrons. They have to be made transverse to preserve the polarization in the ring. Then when they come down to the interaction region, they have to have their polarization flipped by a solenoid. It's all worked out. We know how to do it. And it's part of the design. Okay, so given that, you can now do all kinds of interesting things, which I'm going to skip over very fast, just to show you the titles. You can look for CP violation in tau production, you can look for CP violation in tau decay, and you have sensitivity to an electric dipole moment. So to do CP violation in tau decay, you basically, do the standard thing you do, produce an invariant like that and search for it by comparing the different decays. Now you can even do this without a polarized beam, but it's a lot better with a polarized beam because you basically become insensitive to detector asymmetries. Okay, you can measure, as I said, the tau magnetic dipole moment, and there is a real part and an imaginary part, and again, I'm not going to spend the time, but basically you can have a sensitivity which at 75 inverse attabarns is interesting for the anomalous part compared to what you measure. This is illegible. I can't even read it. But it's a sensitivity which is interesting in the context of what you've learned about first generation things from atoms and neutrons. Okay. So basically, there's a whole range of phenomena. It's, I think, rather pointed. Okay, you can make you. There's no single prize, perhaps with the exception of lepton flavor violation, which would be a good thing. So there, here are four supersymmetry models. Here are four extra dimension models. Here are classes of measurements: CP violating asymmetries, changes in mixing, rare decay phenomena, other things like DD bar mixing, lepton flavor violation, etc. The point is that you can see a pattern of measurements which gives you an almost unique distinction between the models. I can't claim it's completely unique, but it's almost unique. Okay? No, this is meant... No, it doesn't. It has no... Here, yellow means no effect. Yellow means no effect, okay? So the point is you wouldn't see anything there, but you would see an effect here, okay? So that's the whole point, okay? So you can transcribe this, and this is just cute. I mean, you can think of this as a DNA chip for new physics. You look at the pattern of phenomena that you've seen or limited, and you just go across and you say, well, that's that, okay? Not quite that simple, but... Okay, so in order to do this, in the last 10 minutes, you need a high luminosity machine. Can you do this? You can also, this machine is also designed to run down at 4 GeV, so you can do things near threshold if they should be interesting. And there are a few things which are, in fact, interesting. Okay. The other question is, well, there is LHCb. That's a next generation flavor experiment at the LHC. Why do you need a super B factor? Well, LHCb will do interesting things, but and there is, of course, some overlap between what the two experiments can do, but there are a lot of things which are unique, and to my taste at least, most of the important things that you want to investigate are things you do at an E plus E minus machine. Okay, I won't dwell any further on that, but the point is the machines are complementary. Okay, so how do you do it? Well, we started out looking at this 5 or 6 years ago, and so did the KEK folks. And so the obvious thing you do is you take your existing machines, you put in more bunches when you can, you increase the current in the bunches, and you have a situation in which there are 10 amperes in the machine, horrendous backgrounds, 100 megawatts of power, etc. So that's probably not the best idea. Okay, so... we do think now that we have a better idea. And let me just spend a few minutes on it. So, I mean, here's... OIDA is the mastermind of the KEK B-factory. And so we've had a couple of joint workshops about this. And he basically said, and I've quoted here, the present design of their machine hits fundamental limits in beam effect and bunch length. Higher order mode problems, coherent synchrotron radiation problems. Higher current is the only way to increase the luminosity. There's many... technical and cost issues are expected with the new RF system. That's an understatement. Okay? So this is what he was basically saying is this is really hard to do. Okay? And he wasn't willing to kind of sign on to the kind of designs that both the KEK and the SLAC groups had because he thought they were impractical for various reasons. So that characterizes what's called the brute force method. Okay, increase the beam currents, increase the focusing, decrease the beta Y star, and decrease the bunch length. These two go together. But these make lots of problems with higher order mode heating, terrible backgrounds, bad, difficult machine optics, very expensive increases in RF voltage, very short Tushek lifetimes, interbeam scattering lifetimes because of the high densities, etc. So you need a new idea. So Pantaleo Raimondi from Frascati had what I think is a new idea. And that is, you make a machine with ultra-low emittances. Basically, we started out this design by taking the so-called MAD deck, the optical deck of the ILC damping ring. That's a 6-kilometer machine. We're now down to an 1,800-meter machine, so there have been some changes. But that was the genesis of this. Low emittance, okay, allowing you then to produce very small betas at the IP. Then the additional thing is the very large crossing angle combined with what's called a crab waist scheme, which I'm not going to try to explain in detail, but I'll try to indicate. Well, I'll show you a picture which I think will make it clear why. The first thing it does is reduce parasitic crossings from neighboring bunches. You don't want the N minus one bunch in one ring to hit the N bunch in the other ring. And that's a limitation right now of the current generation of machines. So you want to avoid that. KEK already has a crossing angle. SLAC has head-on collisions. It's clear everybody wants to go to a crossing angle. But the additional interesting feature here is what's called a crab waist, which is a set of sextipoles which interchanges the longitudinal degree of freedom with the horizontal transverse degree of freedom. And I'll show you, I think I can make that plausible in the next slide. Anyway, we've put this into a conceptual design report, which is under review by INFN. We had our first review meeting 2 weeks ago. And if the review is favorable, the idea is that INFN will go to the ministry and ask for a major contribution to an international project. But let's get back to the physics. So here are some parameter lists of PEP2, KEK-B, the super PEP2 with high currents, the super KEK-B with the high currents, and the new super B. And there's a whole lot of stuff here. I'm not going to make you look at all of them, but let's just compare, for example, the current KEK-B with super B, because you get an idea. So here, in an anamorphic scale, but the same anamorphic scale for both of them, is what the beams look like at current KEK. They're in this level, big fat things, and they have a crossing angle, but you can see that basically one beam goes right through the other beam all the time. In this design, you can see with this big crossing angle and very small sizes that the beams only one portion of the beam collides with a different portion of the beam. Everybody interacts with everybody. You get all your bang for a buck, but the optics disturbance of the interaction region is much smaller. Okay? And the beams themselves are much smaller, so the luminosity is much higher for a given current. You can also see this crab waist concept where the beams are being brought to a focus just at this central point. Okay, not every place along, but just at this central crossing point. That's the crab waist idea. So what's the difference? Well, first, we've been able to reduce the energy asymmetry. Because these beams are smaller, you can make a smaller beam pipe, you can make the first measurement closer. That saves a lot of money in operating. But you can see that the number of particles in the bunch is the same. The currents are the same. Okay, I didn't show you here what the currents were, for example, in super KEK-B, 9 and 4 amperes. Okay, so here, these are big numbers too, and they scared us when we initially did them, but we've done them, and this is the same kind of currents. Okay, the crossing angle, instead of being plus or minus 15, is plus or minus 24 milliradians. The bunch lengths are similar. They are not really squeezed down. Okay, but the sizes of the beams are very much smaller, in particular vertically. Okay, instead of 2 microns, 39 nanometers. Okay? And here, this luminosity is 1.6 10 to 34, and this is 10 to 36.
You need a lot less water power to make that thinner.
The wall plug power has to do with the currents you're supporting and the loss of energy due to synchrotron radiation, and that's why reducing the energy asymmetry, it goes basically like the square of the energy of the high energy ring. So, okay, so the net result is that we use less, less power substantially than we do now. And we get two orders of magnitude increase in current. Mm-hmm. Well, together with all these other details, okay. These are just things I already pointed out. So I won't justify how we can go to a smaller beam pipe, but we hit with the smaller beam pipe, we get the same vertex precision measurement that we do now, and it allows us to do this. Okay, so here's a layout of the beamline components. The interesting thing about this is we take the existing PEP magnets and reconfigure the optics and are able to use almost all the magnets. And because we're supporting the same currents, we are able to use the same RF system, an RF system which works very well and was very expensive. There, you have to solve some problems in the interaction region design. We've done that. I'll skip that. This is not important except to a machine physicist, but this is a tune plot. And if you've ever looked, this is actually one for two interaction regions. But if you've ever looked at a tune plot in an ordinary machine, you have a very tiny region where you can operate without, getting unstable. In this machine, in fact, you have this incredibly broad regime where you can run. It's due to the crab waist and the big crossing angle. And this machine is not pushed to the limit. You can see here the luminosity as a function, for example, of the bunched density and the other things that go along with that. And you can see that there is an increase here. You can get up to around here before anything goes bluey. And so I didn't show it to you, but there is a parameter list for this machine that goes to 4 10 to the 36, which you would do by adding RF in an upgrade if that were warranted. Okay. Because the currents are very similar, Babar makes a very good basis for an upgrade, so you save a lot of money there. You do want to change a lot of things. You need a new drift chamber because ours is kind of worn out. You need to build a newer and better vertex detector. Need to build a new end cap calorimeter, etc. A bunch of things. But basically, Babar is a very good basis for that. Okay. So here is a realistic luminosity profile, which as a function for a decade of running, which shows how you accumulate luminosity. In other words, you come on at less than full luminosity. After the first run, the assumption is that you're at full luminosity. That's exactly what PEP2 did. You then keep that luminosity, the 10 to 36 luminosity. Okay. You then build up, and this shows just going to 2.5 10 to the 36. And this is the integrated value, so that over 10 years, if you ran that long, you'd in fact have 160 inverse atomic. Okay, where? This is the Rome II University. Here, this is the main building. This is where the machine would go underground. Here is the Frascati Laboratory, and that's the building in which the Daphne accelerator is. If you look at a Google picture, here is where Super B would go. Here is Frascati. So it's 3 kilometers away. And here's a picture of the footprint. You have to make sure you don't go into the Roman ruins and all that kind of stuff, but it's okay. Okay, how much? So this is not something I can answer in a single sentence because for two reasons. One is, as is now de rigueur, we did the costs in ILC style. Okay, that means they're impossible to understand. It means that you do man years of labor and engineering and design, and then you have capital cost. This is, of course, done in euros. And then there is replacement value of the components that we want to contribute as the U.S. contribution, and you can see that they are very substantial. Okay, this is now $70 million, right? And $180 million of accelerator components that the U.S. can contribute without writing a check, effectively. Okay, and this is then the additional cost. So it's not a lot. I mean, if you were to add everything up and ask, how much do you have to write a check for at some reasonable rate for these people and this kind of costs, and assuming this just is not paid for, the answer is around $400,000. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's just, never mind. That's a... No. I'm sorry. The reason... No. Kilo euro. I'm sorry. The numbers. I was remembering a number. It's a wrong number. Excuse me. Never mind. Here are the numbers. Okay. You can put whatever multipliers you want. Okay. No. I mean, here you would get a negative number if you do that here, right? It's not that good a deal. Okay, just to show you, this is the RF system. It works perfectly well for these purposes. Okay, so time scale. This is complicated because it's an inherently international project. A new organization would be set up. It would not be run by Frascati, because that's a national laboratory. The idea is it'd be a new international umbrella thing, but not the ILC management. I mean, some light, low level. No, I mean, this is, I think, possible to do without a lot of heavy lifting, in fact. We're still developing a budget model, but it would be based on this, they call ad hoc, one-time contribution from the Italian government. The region of Lazio, which has access independently to EU funds, is seriously interested in developing the site, making the tunnel, and building the conventional facilities. No, it's on the campus, but most of it is underground, and then there's an office building, and but it's perfectly, you know, it's people walk around slack too. I mean, that's okay. Then there will of course be contributions to the INFN budget. As I said, EU funds. Other countries have, particular France and the UK and Spain at this point are making application to EU. Then our in-kind contribution, that would be the dominant U.S. contribution, and then there'd be some small things. We think this would take 4 to 5 years to build, because remember, a lot of it already actually exists. And that's all it took to build BEP, in fact. Okay, so conclusion. As I started out, the B factories and the Tevatron have subjected the quark sector of the Standard Model to unique, stringent new experimental tests, which the Standard Model has passed. But now we can take this body of knowledge and use it as a calibration to study in detail rare penguin-dominated B meson decays, as well as flavor-changing neutral carbon lepton flavor decays, which I think may be the most interesting thing here. And if, in fact, there are new particles at roughly the TeV scale that are found at the LHC, I think it's reasonably clear that you will see these effects in flavor in these experiments, and they will be the key to understanding new physics in the flavor sector, which is really difficult to get at in detail at the LHC high PT experiments. And in fact, new sources of CP violation are bound to be there at some level, and we have reasonable sensitivity. So this is made possible then by a new generation of experiments, which incorporates several interesting innovative ideas, this large Povinsky angle, large crossing angle, to get 10 to 36, including the ability to make polarized taus, which is the key to a detailed understanding of lepton flavor violating couplings if we're fortunate enough to find them. And so pending approval by the appropriate committees, which is not a done deal, it really looks like INFN is willing to host this collider on the Rome II University campus as part of an international collaboration. And so we are working to see to it that we can secure this U.S. contribution of in-kind components toward this project. Okay, thank you. No. There is an experiment at KEK which has achieved these emittances in a working accelerator. And there has been a separate experiment at SLAC which has shown the appropriate amount of demagnification. So I don't think there is anything to prove in that. In those points, I think what you have to do is just take what you know and engineer it. This, of course, has a degree of technical complementarity with the ILC, which you might think would be a good thing. What I'm learning is not a good thing, because ILC is having a lot of difficulty getting R&D funds at the level which is really needed to get a good start. So the issue is not that, you know, we're 5% of $10 billion, so that's in the noise. The issue is the money ILC wants in the next few years is of the scale of, you know, the same thing that you would need for this. And so we're regarded actually by some people as a threat, which I find funny. But what does Barry Barish think of this? He has been actually quite encouraging, and in fact put us in touch with people who have done some of the collective effect calculations, because, you know, there's a lot of expertise in that damping ring, etc. So because he saw this potential synergy. But I think he's been, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he's been less encouraging as he sees that this actually maybe is getting some legs and it may be drawing on the same funds in the next 5 years. But I think, you know, well, I said 4 or 5 years. Okay, the time scale is the following. We have a CDR. We have a 500-page conceptual design report. It was that blue cover that I flashed by. Okay, that is under review. We think you can have a TDR with, you know, real worked-out engineering solutions, et cetera, in 2 years. With how much money to make a TDR? We have a meeting. No. No, but it's not a billion. It's not a billion. No, it's not. David, I'm not going to argue about factors, but it's not a billion. But, okay, look, it's of the scale of big new experiments in neutrino physics, it's the scale of the next thing you want to do that isn't a giant new accelerator at the forefront, right? No, we don't have, we have people working at Frascati, we have people working at SLAC, we have people working at Orsay. We even have a couple of people working at KK. That's not enough of a team. We, in fact, have a meeting tomorrow morning to try to hash out what resources we really think we need for a TDR. But the answer is certainly not $100 million. Okay. This is not being done ILC style. Okay, let me just put it that way. It's being done the way we have done things in the last generation. Well, they have solved the main problem. So what needs to be done here, as I said, there's no RF system to engineer. There are, you need to engineer a new vacuum pipe with less higher order mode losses. That's a straightforward problem. We know how to do it. Okay. We need to make of the order of 50 new magnets, because most of the magnets are the same magnets. Okay. And we need to do the appropriate technical work to develop the solutions for the detector subsystem issues, none of which is a huge technical stretch, all of which are, you know, kind of straightforward next steps that you can just do. So our estimate, I'm sure, will come out at the level of more like $20 million. Do we need Japan? That's a complicated question. Yes, we would love to have a joint effort. Okay, and we have had, as I said, a couple of joint workshops and lots of other contacts, and we've never managed to somehow come to an agreement, which doesn't mean that it can't be done. Okay, so I'll tell you what the situation in Japan is at the moment, as I understand it, which is their high current machine, which they costed, by the way, at 450 oko yen, which is at this point $600 million or something, okay, is not likely to go ahead, okay, because it's a 100 megawatt machine and all these problems. They have a new proposal before the Director General to make relatively minor improvements, adding some RF, so that they could come up to, after 5 years, a luminosity of 2×10^35. Okay, where there's a factor of 2 floating around it, really, more realistically, 10^35. Because that factor of 2 is based on something called crab cavities, which turn the beams before the collision, which they have tested and hasn't worked. But they're actually still including the factor. So we can argue about a factor too. So that means they, if this were to be accepted, they could have a machine that starts to run producing one or two inverse atom burns a year on a time scale of 5 years from now. Now, that puts you in a kind of never-never land of physics. It really isn't enough of an increase to give you the kind of sensitivities you need to see these important things and make these measurements. So I don't understand exactly how the Japanese system works in detail. I mean, they have already had committee reports which say that that level of an increase is not worth doing. But that doesn't mean that it won't happen. And that's what they're pushing for. I completely agree. That's you would like to find a way to go forward together. If that way to go forward were with this type of a machine at KEK, that would be perfectly fine with me. Okay, but we have been unable to get there from here. Now, everybody's still talking. Nobody's got a check yet. So those things might still happen too. Every RF bucket is filled. There's no reason why not to with this 24 millirating crossing angle. There's no parasitic crossing.